Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. I am recording this in January of 2019, and because my life got crazy, this is the last part of our Christmas series. So, who doesn't love Christmas in January? This episode is entitled Dear Maya 2018. On the last episode of the Paradox Podcast, I wrote and then read a letter to my son, Bodhi. I do this every year because my son and my daughter's birthday are so close to Christmas, and so the second part of our Christmas series is a letter to my daughter, Maya. So let's begin, shall we? Dear Maya, 5 years ago tonight, on December 22, 2013, your mother and I went out to eat at Lotus Garden. While at the meal, your mother began to experience regular contractions in between bites of Veggie General Chicken. With fear and excitement in my voice, I asked Kimmy, "Is it time to go to the hospital?" "No," she responded, "not yet." The next day, December 23, your mom woke me up at 6 a.m. and said, "Now it's time to go to the hospital." 22 hours later, at 4:01 in the morning on December 24, your mother pushed with all of her might. Your lungs began to scream with all of their might, and you were born into God's beautiful creation. Maya, I am dumbfounded by the fact that you have grown from a baby that I can hold in my arms into Wonder Woman in the span of 5 short years. Happy birthday, Maya. The past 5 years have been the best 5 years of my life. And Merry Christmas to my Christmas Eve baby. Your birth has forever changed and shaped the way I soak in the Christmas story. On your second birthday and every year since, I have written you a letter to talk to you about the Christmas story, the past year of your life, and the next year of your life. When I think about these 2 years next to each other, the thing that I am struck by is your growing independence. With each day, Maya, you are living more and more off the leash. You have your own feelings, your own stories, your own experiences, your own sense of humor, and your own handwriting. This unique ownership of life is what every parent desires for their children. However, Maya, you will find that with every step you take toward self-sufficiency will also be a step toward greater complexity of how to live this life well. In this letter, I will share with you 3 stories. Then I will talk about how these 3 stories teach us about independence. And lastly, I will close this letter by sharing a little bit of advice. So let's begin with the first story. 2 weeks ago, our family went on a suburban odyssey in our Honda Odyssey. Mom announced that this epic quest required a stop at Target because all good mothers need to stop at Target. And in an effort to save time, we decided to embark on an efficient drop mom off while we circle the parking lot operation. We arrived at Target, Mom bolted out of the car, and we began our excursion through parking lot purgatory. But something strange interrupted our routine circling. On the sidewalk in front of Target, we saw 3 police cars parked in a helter-skelter fashion. Their sirens sat silent, but the alternating red and blue lights ran in obnoxious overdrive. Next to the police cars stood 5 police officers around a white woman whose head hung down. "Daddy," you said, "what's that?" I began to freely effuse words about crime, punishment, the law, and justice. I speculated that the person on the ground had, most likely, taken something from Target without paying for it. "She tried to steal something," I explained, "and the police caught her." You took in the words I said, thought for a moment, and then asked, "Daddy, what's going to happen to her?" "Well, Maya," I said, "she will probably go to jail." Another pause and another question. "Daddy, have you ever gone to jail?" "No," I responded. "I try my best to keep the law." "That's good," you said. "Daddy, I don't want to go to jail." "Well, Maya," I said in a moment of parenting bliss, "you don't have to go to jail. All you have to do is keep the law." Story number 2. 1 week after story number 1, story number 2 began with a present from your great aunt Marilee. Now, your great aunt Marilee is great for 2 reasons. She is literally great, And she is literally your great aunt Merrily because she is my father's sister. For your birthday this year, Merrily gave you a book entitled Lady Legends Alphabet. In this book, B is for Beyonce, All Hail the Queen and May She Live Forever. C is for Marie Curie and Z is for Zaha Hadid. You love this book from the moment you opened it because you admire strong women. The first time we read this book, we meticulously examined each letter in Lady Legend. As I read every page, you asked me, Daddy, what did she do? This was one of my favorite moments with you, and I felt like, with the assistance of Merrily, I was being a great parent. Until we hit the letter P, because P is for Rosa Parks. Right on cue, you said, Daddy, what did she do? Well, I began, Rosa Parks lived in Alabama and went to work one day. After working really hard, she got on the bus to go home and she found an open seat and sat down to rest for the remainder of her bus ride. But after a few stops, people began to fill the bus. The bus became so full that a white man approached Rosa Parks and told her that she needed to give up her seat for another white man because she was a black woman. Rosa Parks heard this request and said, "No." This one syllable made the white man very angry. "I will have you arrested if you don't stand up this instant," he screamed. And Rosa Parks calmly said, "You may do that." The white man called the police. The police arrived, and they arrested Rosa Parks, and she went to jail. Your eyes became wide. "She went to jail?" you asked. And I said, "Yes, she did, Maya." But before I could explain, you said, "So Rosa Parks is a bad girl?" "Well, no, Maya," I said, but then you interjected and said, "But she went to jail." Story number 3. To tell this story, I will read from the second letter of Luke's gospel. In those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration and was taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. All went to their own towns to be registered. Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David called Bethlehem, because he was descended from the house and the family of David. He went to be registered with Mary, to whom he was engaged and who was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for her to deliver her child, and she gave birth to the firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them at the inn. Now, what I find fascinating about the way that Luke tells this story is the order in which he reveals details. In the chapter before the passage we just read, Luke tells us that Joseph is a descendant of David. Then he reveals that Joseph's fiancée is pregnant, not by way of Joseph, but by way of the Holy Spirit. Then, in the current passage, Luke tells us that Joseph and Mary are required to go to Bethlehem. He reminds us that Joseph is still a descendant of David and that Mary is still pregnant. When Joseph and Mary arrive in Bethlehem, the time arrives for the child to be born. Mary then delivers her firstborn son, and this should be the end of the birthing story. But it's after the announcement that Jesus is born that Luke reveals some very strange pre- and postpartum details. After the baby is born, Luke says that Mary places her Jesus in a trough because this whole time they are in a stable. And then Luke closes the Christmas story with a push over the edge when he writes there was no place for them in the inn. Now, Maya, I want to invite you to imagine this off-camera scene at the inn for a moment. Here's Mary, who is presumably 9 months pregnant. Toward the end of their trek, she is hours away from her first birth, which means she is most likely experiencing regular, painful contractions, and there is no epidural salvation on the horizon. Not only that, but this is Mary's first time giving birth. She lives in the ancient world with a high infant mortality rate and a significant maternal death ratio. She is frightened at the prospect of feeling immense pain, and she also holds no guarantee that her baby or her will survive to see the next day. Mary is intensely experiencing all of these things while traveling 70 miles from Nazareth to Bethlehem, over terrible roads in the desert sun. Joseph is probably attempting to say reassuring words to her like, "We're almost there," or "Hang on a little bit longer, and we'll be in Bethlehem in no time." Finally, they arrive in Bethlehem. They are relieved to see the elevation of the hotel, and they rush into the lobby with Mary screaming in agony and Joseph saying, "We need a room now." But the manager, the innkeeper, and the owner look at Mary in labor and coldly say, "Sorry, all of our rooms are booked." I picture Joseph's hands beginning to shake. He looks around frantically at the other hotel guests and say, "Will anyone please give up their room for my wife? She is going to have a baby any minute now." And there is a tragic silence as the hotel guests look down at their feet and think to themselves, "Sorry, buddy, you should have planned ahead better. It's not my problem you need a hotel room on a busy night." I can also imagine Mary in between contractions wondering where on earth that impregnating Holy Spirit is right now. Would it be too much trouble for the omnipresent birth father to show up in a blaze of glory and say, "Mortals, bow before me and give this woman a room"? But that's not the Christmas story. The story is that a woman is in labor, and every last self-centered person in that crowded inn says, "Nope, not giving up my room tonight." Mary is forced to give birth in a barn and place her newborn in a feed box. Merry Christmas. Maya, each of these three stories about a thief, about Rosa Parks, and about Mary teach us about independence. The thief story is a story about justice. Stealing is a sin, and society needs limits on an individual's independence in order to ensure independence for all. For example, a person's right to wave their fists around ends at the edge of my nose. Stealing is a sin, and there needs to be punishment to dissuade stealing, as well as proactive measures taken so that individuals do not feel they need to steal to survive. But just because someone steals does not mean that we should make them suffer for the rest of their life. Our country is at its best when we treat our criminals with decency and respect. The story in front of Target is a reminder that justice is necessary for independence, and independence without justice is anarchy. Which brings us to Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks was homeschooled until the age of 11, when she was accepted into Montgomery Industrial School in Alabama. This school was founded by whites who wanted to improve the quality of education for black women. It was burned down twice by arsonists and shunned by the white community. 30 years after she began her schooling there, at the age of 42, Rosa Parks challenged an unjust justice system by sitting down on a bus seat. Later in her life, Ms. Parks was asked what the most valuable lesson she learned in all of her years at Montgomery Industrial School was. She replied that, "I learned that I was a person with dignity and self-respect, and I should not set my sights lower than anybody else just because I am black." Why did Rosa Parks refuse to stand when asked? Because she learned that she was a person with dignity and self-respect. And how does one take on a corrupt and racist system of power? By believing that we have dignity, confidence, and honor. Maya, if you live life without dignity, you have this foreboding sense that the political system owns you, that you are helpless, and that the only option a person has is to surrender and comply with the wishes of those who are in power. The story of Rosa Parks teaches us that independence without self-respect is oppression. Which brings us to the story of Mary. Currently, Maya, you have aunties, uncles, grandparents, and parents that drop everything the moment you start crying, well, most times you start crying, and tend to you. As parents, your mother and I try to shield you from being wronged or hurt by another, but at some point, you will grow out of our protection. Mary faced these vulnerabilities when, in the full strain of childbirth, she arrived at an inn seeking shelter, and everyone reacted with apathy. Earlier in this letter, I asked you to imagine the day that Mary gave birth. Now imagine when Mary returns to Bethlehem 10 years later. She probably bristles as she sees the hotel where no one helped her. She purposely walks on different streets to avoid seeing that structure again. Just being in the city of Bethlehem, she is reminded of the calloused indifference of humanity. And 10 years ago, Mary was wronged. There is no question about that. Everyone in that inn 10 years ago should be ashamed of themselves. But after the initial rage has subsided, and Mary has 10 years of life between her and the incident, Mary has a choice to make. Will she begrudge the people at the inn on Christmas Eve? Or will she forgive the people at the inn on Christmas Eve? Now, if she chooses to begrudge the inn, she will be justified in her anger, but she will probably also be miserable. However, if she chooses to forgive the inn, she will abandon her anger, but she may also find peace. Which brings us to the idea that this story can teach us about independence. Independence without forgiveness is bitterness. The story of Mary is a reminder that forgiveness is necessary for independence. Maya, the thing that's interesting about forgiveness is that many human beings feel that forgiveness is a betrayal of justice and self-respect. To say I forgive you to the person who has flagrantly wronged you can be perceived as enabling bad behavior. So we often burrow down, fight with tooth and nail, and make sure that we point out how we were wronged over and over again. Most people think that to forgive someone is to say, it's no big deal, and then act like the sin never happened. But Maya, this is a poor understanding of what forgiveness actually is. To illustrate the power of forgiveness, imagine that same scene in Bethlehem. Mary is there with her 10-year-old son, Jesus. If Mary has not forgiven the people at the inn, then she will point to that building and tell the story of her isolated pregnant suffering and say, Jesus, human beings are horrible and will most likely let you down. You should always keep your guard up. But if Mary has forgiven the people at the inn, then she will point to that building and tell the story of her isolated pregnant suffering and say, Jesus, if you are ever at an inn, with a room that is paid for and booked, and you are settled in your room, in your bed with the lights off, and suddenly you hear a woman in labor bursting through the door, asking for a room, and she's about to deliver a baby. Then Jesus, my son, you give up your room. You go sleep in the stable. Because, Jesus, she says, blinking back tears, we must always help others who are in need. That's what matters in life. This is forgiveness. This is self-respect. And this is justice. The definition of the word forgive is to stop feeling angry or resentful towards someone for an offense, flaw, or mistake. I love that definition. Because if Mary can find a way to let go of anger and resentment despite the suffering that she endured, well, that would be a miracle, wouldn't it? Because the apathy at the inn is a terrible story, but it pales in comparison to the crucifixion of Jesus. According to John's Gospel, Mary is at the foot of the cross as her son, Jesus, is tortuously dying. Mary knows full well that it was her religion that put Jesus on the cross, and her tax dollars were funding a system that was allowing him to die. How do you forgive that? If Mary could do her life all over again, I picture the angel Gabriel appearing before her in angelic glory, boldly announcing that she is pregnant with the Son of God and that God is with humanity in all of their struggles and triumphs. But knowing all that is before her, Mary would probably interject and say, Gabriel, before you go, could you teach me how to forgive? Maya, this world has an enormous amount of suffering, betrayal, death, pain, heartache, cruelty, and uncertainty. How we come to terms with unavoidable catastrophes is at the heart of the human experience. In his book, Looking for Alaska, Author John Green describes all of the suffering we face in our independent lives as a labyrinth. The labyrinth is a fantastic metaphor because suffering can disorient, frustrate, wear us down, and lead us into despair. But in this same book, John Green discusses that the way that we survive in the labyrinth is that we learn how to forgive. The definition of forgiveness is good, but when we consider this term with a lifelong trajectory, then forgiveness is how one makes peace with the suffering of the world. Maya, as you continue to grow and mature and become an independent woman, the most valuable thing that you can learn and the most valuable thing that your mother and I can show you is how to forgive while holding on to justice and self-respect. What few people discuss about forgiveness is that it is a unique experience depending on the situation you encounter. You have to custom fit the words, the time, the compromises, the reprimands, and the encouragement, depending on who you are dealing with and what needs to be forgiven. In other words, there is no template for how to forgive yourself when you have exercised poor judgment. There is no roadmap for how to make peace with life when someone attacks you. There is no manual for how to grow out of bitterness when you are betrayed. Preaching sermons on forgiveness is difficult because of the intimate nature of forgiving another human being. Forgiveness is always a case-by-case basis that takes heart, courage, faith, and persistence. While forgiveness may seem daunting, the unfolding story throughout all of Scripture is that the path of forgiveness is where God is encountered. The specifics of forgiveness vary wildly based on the situation. But there is something consistently present in all of healthy forgiveness. Self-respect. Self-respect is the kick drum of every inspiring forgiveness story. Self-respect is always the foundation whenever miraculous forgiveness occurs. Human beings cannot forgive without a healthy amount of self-respect. The pursuit of forgiveness and love for enemies and enjoying God's beautiful creation all begins with seeing the image of the divine in yourself. And if you ever find it impossibly difficult to forgive another human being, Maya, then return to yourself and ask, is this forgiveness problem rooted in my lack of self-respect? Which brings me to you and your young and vibrant life. Self-respect always asks the self a question. Do you believe that you are worthy to be loved? Maya, I am confident that you are worthy to be loved. Just a few months ago, you began your first day of pre-K. Before you left for school, I took a video and asked you a question. What do you want to be when you grow up? Here is your response. A doctor, a dentist, a teacher, a fire girl, a veterinarian, and a police officer. With all those careers, Maya, you will need a lot of training. You'll start your first job sometime around the year 2054, and your student loans will be the equivalent of the GDP of Liechtenstein. Maya, what I love about you is your ambition. But let's assume for a minute that you do it. All of it. That you are somehow able to pull off becoming educated and proficient in all six of your desired careers. In this scenario, an arsonist ignites an animal shelter in the city of Los Angeles on fire. Now, in this scenario, people don't call the police. They don't call the fire department. They don't call an ambulance. They just call Maya Lynn Hadley. And she arrives on the scene, puts the fire out, tends the sick, resuscitates the animals, and catches the arsonist. Once the arsonist is taken downtown, she returns to the site of the burned out structures and offers free dental care for the community while teaching students about the practice of dentistry. Maya, you are the entire Paw Patrol team rolled into one. Now that would be something worthy of respect. Maya, you would be on the front page of every newspaper if people still read newspapers in 2054. You'd be trending on Twitter, you'd get 1 billion followers on Instagram, and then after accomplishing all of those things, you may be tempted to think, now I am worthy of being loved. But Maya, can I tell you something? That feeling that being an uplifting hero would make you worthy of love? Well, it would be a lie. Because when you listen to the words and stories of people who have accomplished more than just about everyone else on the planet, they testify to a very different reality. In 1920, Philo T. Farnsworth invented the television at the age of 21. 21! He dreamed up how a television could work at the age of 14. Maya, can you imagine having this much success at such a young age? We assume that Farnsworth went on to live a life overflowing with a sense of accomplishment and a surety that he was worthy to be loved. But shortly after he invented the television, Farnsworth began to drink heavily, and he struggled throughout his life with chronic alcoholism. The actor Jim Carrey used to be the highest paid actor in all of Hollywood. He reached the summit of a career that throngs of people desire. A few years ago at a graduation speech, Jim Carrey said, "I wish everyone could have their dreams come true so they could realize that it isn't the answer." The notorious B.I.G. made a ton of money in his career and then famously said, "Mo money, mo problems." New York Times bestselling author Anne Lamott wrote to aspiring authors who desire to be published, "Many of the saddest, meanest, most jealous and destructive people I have known or dated have been highly successful writers. So do not write thinking that publication of your writing will fill in the Swiss cheesy holes in your soul, or hoping that your writing will bring you personal improvement, because it won't." Maya, do not fall for the frightening temptation that you will discover self-respect in your accomplishments. Do not believe the deceitful idea that you can earn your self-respect. A few months ago, a friend recently asked me, "Craig, what would you do if Maya became the lead singer in a good old country band?" My friend asked me this because he was trying to set me up for failure. He knew I possessed a strong distaste for country music. I asked my friend, "Like, how country is this band?" "Oh, Craig," he said, "this band is the twangiest, the drolliest, the cowboy hat and bootiest, honkiest, tonkiest, sly guitariest country band in all of Alabama." I turned to my friend. I looked him dead in the eye and said with confidence, "Well, let me tell you what I would do. I would learn every word to every song on every album by this band. I would go to as many concerts in as many cities as I could possibly attend and run their merch table. I would buy the t-shirt, the boots, and the cowboy hat. I would sing along during those shows with so much joy, the other fans at her show would look at me and say, 'That guy is as happy as a hog in poop.'" My friend heard my answer and said, "No way, I don't believe it." "Believe it," I responded, and then continued, "I'm assuming that my daughter is happy. And in your story, it sounds like she loves the music she is creating, that she is overwhelmed with happiness because she gets to live her dream. If the engine of her career is joy in the music she plays, then I'm all in." Why do I tell you this story, Maya? Because I believe that you are a creative expression of the divine. Your life's work is to discover and become who God has created you to be. And if God created you to be a country singer and you know it in your bones and it fills you with joy because you get to make music, well then, boy howdy, I'm in. I will walk with you as much as you will let me. Because watching you grow into the person God has created you to be is one of the most rewarding and enjoyable things I have found in this life. And who cares if you sell 2 million records or if you sell 2 records? It doesn't matter, because you just love to make the music. Maya, the moment you were born, your resume was blank. Your report card read incomplete. Your name lacked fancy initials at the end of it. You couldn't play an instrument. You couldn't sing. You couldn't dance. You couldn't read, and you couldn't write. But you were worthy of every ounce of love your mother and I could give you. Because from the very first moment we saw a positive pregnancy test, your mother and I felt something permanent stirring in our souls. You are worthy of love exactly the way you are. You are worthy of love exactly the way you are. You are worthy of love exactly the way you are. You are made in the image of God, and God makes no mistakes. Our hope is that you will see in yourself what we see in you. Our prayer is that you will look inward and see the beauty that God created. Whenever you doubt yourself or feel that you cannot forgive, or you fail an exam, or have been ignored in your moment of need, or you cannot let go of your bitterness, take a deep breath, look inward, and know with full confidence that you are worthy to be loved. May you find the courage to love who God has created you to be. May you be a person who can draw on that self-respect to live a life of miraculous forgiveness like Mary. And may you forgive while holding on to self-respect and justice. I am proud of you, Maya. I love you so much just the way you are. I also cannot wait to see who you become in the next year, because whoever she is, I will love her with all of my being. Love, Dad.